This is the beginning of our study together of glimpses of Maha Mudra, or the practice instructions of the Vidyadhara Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. So this is actually a fourth retreat here, and so we're actually able to talk about this topic in a beautiful setting, and also within a broader setting of the many people who, invisible online folks, who I'd like to acknowledge as well, although they don't exist yet. Or maybe they do, but they're doing something else right now. So it's rather intimidating to be talking about a topic such as Maha Mudra. It is the essential heart-blood teachings of the Kagyu lineage, and it is the heart of what the Vidyadhara presented to his students in his teaching in North America. So today I wanted to give a little bit of background and a little bit on the view, that a view of Maha Mudra. Maha Mudra is a Sanskrit term. Maha can mean big or great. Mudra can mean gesture or seal or symbol. It has many meanings. But briefly, Maha Mudra means great symbol. And we'll be talking about that in many ways over the course of this week. So there are a couple of lineages that come together in the Maha Mudra tradition. And it's really interesting to begin first by acknowledging the great honor and blessing that to receive these teachings, but also get a sense of, I guess you call two main streams that come together in the Maha Mudra tradition. One is called the long lineage and one is called the short lineage. I'm not quite sure why. The many teachers trace Maha Mudra back to the early Mahasiddhas of India, in particular to a famous Mahasiddha known as Saraha. That's one lineage. And it's interesting, one thing I love about Maha Mudra is when you look into the origins, you see there are actual real people. Real people like us, and doing in many styles, many types that were attracted or longed deeply or were willing to completely disrupt their lives in search of wisdom, in search of understanding and realization. And even better, they started out confused and made many, many mistakes along the way. They were real. They were genuine. I can relate to them, kind of. So the notion of siddha just means realized having attained spiritual powers of some sort. The highest siddha is the realization of wisdom, attainment of complete non-conceptual direct understanding of the nature of reality. There were lots of them. And there's a kind of a style of the Siddha lineage of non-institutionalization, that most of the stories of the Mahasiddhas were somebody, Joe Schmo, decides to go look for a teacher, and they wander around and go through many adventures, and somehow they end up encountering a teacher who then instructs them. So the instruction is very individual, personal, human, from one person to another, and it took many forms. It tended to be in a poetic form, or in the form of gestures, or in the form of creating situations. It wasn't a systematic presentation, but it was evocative style of teaching, working with whatever the student brought. The teacher would create the situation needed for that student to awaken. The other thing about the Mahasiddhas is that they had active lives. They were doing things. They had jobs. Many of them were like working class people. It wasn't a philosophical or a kind of academic quest. It was a quest much deeper than that, coming out of realizations of difficulty of life, the need to change, the raw quality of life. And it came, there was such a yearning, such a yearning for wisdom, that these early explorers, these Indian Siddha tradition, were willing to put themselves through harsh discipline, upsetting weird situations, challenging enigmatic teachings, and stick with it, because of having some kind of glimpse drew them forward, some kind of glimpse of reality. Sometimes Mahamudra is talked about just very simply as seeing things as they are. And the implication, of course, is that we don't, and we'll talk more about that. But the idea is that some kind of way in the frozen structure of our emotional mind, heart, body, there are little breaks, little kind of cracks in the system where a little bit of insight comes through. And that begins to haunt us. You know, as Vijayara was talking, we become haunted because we have the pain of seeing those gaps, how that close up. And then we're back in our regular old world, and it really sucks even more than it did before. It's sort of like if you're used to being in a slum, it's fine with you until you visit your friend in a mansion. Next thing you think, wait a minute, something's missing here. So some of these, Sara happened to be an arrow maker, worked with an arrow maker, a woman. That was his job. That's it called Sarahara, as an arrow maker. Other Mahasiddhas had other jobs. They ground sesame oil, or some of them were academic and very learned. Some of them were basically like homeless people, living on the streets and eating garbage. You never knew what they were like. There was no one type. So another thing about the origins in the Siddha tradition is that it completely cuts through all sorts of wimpy notions of spirituality and deluded ideas of what it is to be realized, what it is to be holy, however, whatever word we want to use. If we have those ideas, we would walk right by these siddhas, never give them a glance. We think that's just a bum on the street, or that's just a weird person. One of the Mahasiddhas is known for being lazy and sleeping all the time. We'd say, that's a lazy bum. You know, we wouldn't see it. You know, so Mahamudra is, how can we see more clearly? How can we not pass by due to our preconceptions? How can we not pass by wisdom that is being offered to us by the world? So that line was very much revered by the Vijayadara. He loved to talk about Saraha and tell Saraha stories. In the early days, when I first started practicing, we were always reading from the songs of Saraha. We didn't really understand what he anything, but we listened to them a lot. And it was very much a part of the training within this tradition in the early days. So the other lineage is the lineage that goes back to the central figure of Vajradhara. And Vajradhara represents non-conceptual direct understanding, the inseparable union of wisdom and compassion, that which cannot be put into any words. So that's why he's a picture. It can't really be put into a picture either, but at least they're trying. But it said the real origin of this other stream, lineage stream, is indescribable essence of awakening. So you could see that as an origin where everything comes from that. Or you could see that as really the undercurrent of all the surface activities that are involved in following a path. And again, from that initial awakening of mind, that lineage became visible in real people, a series of real people that traditionally are described as the originators of the Kagyu tradition. The first were Indian masters. And so there's a link there with the Mahasiddhas. Tilopa was, a boy tending his goats or something, whatever he was tending, goats or sheep or cows. And his story is that he had a dream or a vision while he's out in the field, encountering a magical hag-like figure, a wake-up call kind of figure, which led him to go on his quest. So that was his story. The next person in the lineage, Naropa, totally different, a very accomplished professor at Nalanda University. Very refined character. So you have your Tilopa, who ends up being the bum on the street, eating fish guts, and then somehow the very refined character then studies with him. Naropa, those are Indian. And then finally you have a Tibetan. Then you have Marpa. Marpa's the transition, the link between the Indian tradition and what became known as Tibetan Buddhism. Marpa was a farmer, quite grumpy, beer drinker, family guy, and a brilliant translator, all rolled into one. So yet another lifestyle. So I don't want to belabor the point, but I want to make clear that this tradition at its heart is not about being a particular kind of person. It's not about being spiritual. It's not about joining some kind of club. It's not about finding some better way to be. It's about looking directly into your own experience and working in the particularities of that experience, not in generalities. There are many ways that Mahamudra is presented. Some people present it totally as its own thing, as its own school. I met students who said, I don't practice Vajrayana, I practice Mahamudra. And I was taken aback when I heard that. These are good students of Trolik Rinpoche. And I thought, huh, it was food for thought. And then exploring more, many of the teachers view Mahamudras particularly suited to the modern age to Westerners. And it's not like L'Adrian in a lot of ways, other aspects. It doesn't require much in the way of rituals. It's not that people go around doing sadhanas and pujas and ringing bells and dorjes and all that kind of stuff. You don't even necessarily need a shrine and or anything. You just need to get down to bare bones and look at your experience directly. So some people don't like forms, don't like rituals and all that kind of stuff. And that would be a perfect kind of way of presenting Mahamudra to such a person. And knowing that is helpful for when we do rituals and we do more elaborate practices, not to forget the core point and get lost in the forms, but stick with the essence. So I wanted you to know how the Vijayadhara presented this particular way of presenting it, and know that there are many ways. It's a very vast tradition. And the Vijayadhara presented Mahamudra within the context of Vajrayana, in fact, within the context of the Triyana tradition. He presented it as the pinnacle of realization of the lower tantra of the Kagyu tradition. And he equated it with a yana, one of the tantric yanas called Anutra Yoga, none higher yoga. So he joined the metaphor of the nine yanas, which is more from a Nyingma tradition, with the Kagyu understanding. So he presented it as the epitome of the Kagyu understanding, lower tantra, and then he went on to talk about Maha'ati in terms of the Nyingma tradition and the highest realization within the tradition. And as a holder of both, he talked in different ways, but he tended to place the Ati teachings as a further development from Mahamudra. Some teachers see them as just different methodologies for doing the same thing. Some people, of course, being humans, have they see this is better, that's better, and all that. But who cares about that, you know? But the powerful thing about the Vijayadhara's presentation, from my perspective, is that he placed such an emphasis on preparing the ground so that the Mahamudra could be really experienced in the way it was meant to be. The problem with Mahamudra teachings, if one could use that word, sorry, is that they're so simple, they're so direct, they're so based on experience that can only be pointed to and inadequately with words, is that they're easy to misunderstand. They're easy to get to think we actually get it when we don't. Very, very easy, because we're very smart and we're very verbal and very conceptual people. So we hear something about the nature of mind, and because we hear it and we can try to use our rational mind to capture that, and it can't be captured in that way. So it's kind of difficult. So the Vijayadhara really emphasized you have to get grounded in sitting practice to have even a chance of really understanding this. You have to place it in the context of the compassion and wisdom and training in the Mahayana way in order to have even a chance of understanding it. The other thing about Mahamudra, which I think can be challenging in the West, if you sometimes just read about various Mahamudra practices and exercises, it can seem like just like fiddling around with little mental games, you know. Why would you do that? How would it benefit? The world is like on fire. Why would you spend time doing that, you know? So placing it within the context of strong determination and aspiration to actually help this suffering world, really, really important. Mahamudra focuses on how we perceive altogether at the most core level. It focuses on the question of what is the nature of mind, what is the nature of phenomena, and what is their relationship. And it starts from the glimpse or the meditative or human realization of the sky-like nature of the mind. That's the starting point, the sky-like nature of the mind. Not the figuring out mind, not the I'm smart and you're dumb mind, not the any particular type of mind. It's like the sky. So the sky, you look at things, there's no limit, there's no boundaries. It's completely pure and open and spacious. Space of mind. You know, a lot of times mind is viewed as a calculator or or a functionary that kind of keep us on track and all that. And this is like going down, below the whole thing and throughout the whole thing, within the whole thing, there's this idea of vast, clear space. And Mahamudra raises the question of awareness, too. It challenges us to connect with the quality of awareness that isn't here or there. It's not ours, and it's not someone else's, and it's not something given to us, or something that's lost. It's not created or built up by, you know, studying hard, and you don't lose it by being forgetful. It's a pervasive awareness. That Vidyadhara pointed to that in the talk as well, a pervasive awareness. And it doesn't come from anywhere. It doesn't go anywhere. It's the nature of that clear sky. So there's a sense of the beginning point of Mahamudra. Most teachers, including the Vidyadhara, emphasize holding a certain view, not forgetting what you're doing, not forgetting who you are. When you have tiny little glimpse of who you are, remember, hold on to that. And you could say, well, that's weird. We're not supposed to hold on to things in Buddhism. You know, we're grasping onto this and that. Well, in fact, you're supposed to hold this view. But this view, you can't really hold it. There's nothing to hold, but you better hold on to it, or you're not holding the view. There's a sense of collapse that often happens. Collapse. That's what happens when we don't hold the view. Our minds shrink, or our mental, or our being shrinks. It collapses, congeals, solidifies. My mother used to tell me, She said, don't make faces like that. Your mind will stay that way. Your face will freeze that way. And it's sort of like we do that with our mind. we scrunch down and they stay that way. So there's a quality in the Mahamudra of noticing, we scrunching down and opens out, is scrunched down and opens out. So we work with that among other things. So I wanted to do a couple of readings to give a sense of two important aspects of being able to glimpse, see things as they are. So it's really simple. There's two sides. We do see things that aren't there. We don't see what is there. That's fundamental Mahamudra teachings. We don't see what's actually going on. We do see what's not going on. And there's a lot of direct exploration of how we perceive things. We perceive in generalities and labels. That's how we perceive. Generalities and labels. So basically, you could say we perceive a world that we made up, and then that reflects back to us. And then we take it to be solid and real. Meanwhile, it's like the clear open sky is like floating by. Hello, hello, here I am. She said, oh, don't see it at all. Yeah. So, since Saraha is credited as the originating figure of the whole thing, I have two short quotes from him. It also gives you a sense of the style of teaching. So, he's teaching in the form of poems and songs, short little things. So this one is about seeing what is not there, first side. Huh? The ignorant press their eyes and see one lamp as two. Like this, in mind's nature, where seer and seen are not two, alas, the mind appears as two things. That's the first. So it goes back again, always comes back to perceiver and perception, you and the phenomenal world. Then, are not two. So that's another theme in terms of the view we'll be working with, is complete inseparability of you and phenomena, perceiver and perception. Not a tiniest bit of difference. There is no way that you can pull anything out of the fabric of the total reality of this very moment. That's the first one. So you can see, they don't spell out, you know, and we'll talk more about there's a systematic approach to teaching, systematized approach to Mahamudra. This is the poetic approach. They're not totally separate, but somewhat. And this is about not seeing what is there. The other was seeing what's not there, not seeing what is there. And so we weren't messed up already, okay. Although many lamps are lit throughout the house, those with no eyes to see remain in darkness. Like this, though spontaneous wisdom is all pervasive and nearby, for the ignorant, it is far, far away. So that's not seeing what is there. That notion of for the ignorant, it is far, far away, I think is very close to the notion that any kind of realization has to be for very special people, for other people. It seems so special, so distant, so unreachable often. You know, we get discouraged and think there's no way, it's far, far away. I don't see, nothing's happening. I sat all 2 days and nothing happened. Pretty far away. Maybe if I sit one more day, I'll get one day closer. I said, you don't get any closer. Sorry to say. That's bad news, but you don't get any further away. That's a good news. You're not going anywhere. The whole notion of the path is different at this point. It's not exactly trying to get anywhere. And it connects with so much the ground. Another thread that was so powerfully presented by the Vijayara's ground is the notion of overcoming cutting spiritual materialism at all its more and more subtle levels. All has to do with fantasy that there's some other place to get to. And our unwillingness to actually be where we are, and our blindness to seeing that as an expression of empty, spontaneous wisdom of mind displayed right here for us. So when the Mahamudra teachings developed over time in Tibet, there were a lot of teachers who took these kind of wild and crazy Siddha expressions and put them into forms to help practitioners relate to this material. I think there was a realization that not everyone heard one stanza from Saraha and got it right away, that a lot of people needed to do a little bit more work. So that's a practical side, and we'll talk more about that. And that gets down to most Mahamudra texts focusing on the subtleties of shamatha, the subtleties of vipassana in particular. Clear seeing, tool, awakening the prajna to be able to see through ego and the ego's projections. So there are many, many texts, very detailed step-by-step ways of looking at things. Yet, even people within that tradition, people like Gampopa, fairly by the books, known for by the books kind of guy. On the side, he was teaching in a more of the Mahasiddha style, I was told. I wasn't there. But I heard that people were a little suspect about him. And in terms of the Vijayadhara, he was doing both. He is very systematic, as you can see, and going back again to step by step, preparing the ground, training people, getting them to the point where they can flash this direct experience. At the same time, he was working in the ways that the Mahasiddha tradition describes, creating situations, challenging people in various ways, working with various individual styles in the kind of forms of their livelihood and forms of their particular major kleshas, etc., in a way that could awaken very unique individuals as opposed to everybody going through one particular way. Just like the Mahasiddhas, he taught people by having them build things, putting them in situations they didn't know anything about, and seeing what happened, appearing in unusual ways, like Milarepa. There's a famous Milarepa story, I think, that gives the really heart of the quality of Mahamudra teachings. And so I'm going to tell it. And there's a lot of Milarepa stories about working with his particular student, Rechungpa, who was really difficult and ornery and pretty much kept screwing up one way or another all the time. And so Milarepa presented various challenges to kind of get Rechungpa snap out of it. And it was difficult. He had many, many stories about it. But in one of the stories, Rechungpa and Milarepa were walking along, and there came to a big plain, and suddenly there was a big hailstorm, a huge hailstorm. And Rechungpa was like, oh my God, a hailstorm. And then he looked around, and Milarepa wasn't there. He said, where did he go? And it said Milarepa went into the, was hiding inside a yak horn. There had been a yak horn lying on the field, you know, they fall off. Milarepa went inside the horn, so he was fine. No hail was hitting him. And meanwhile, he was enjoying seeing Rechungpa getting battered by hail outside. And people asked Trungpa Rinpoche about this story. That's really weird. Does it mean he like shrank or something? And what's that about? It doesn't make any sense. And Trungpa Rinpoche said, the point is, Milarepa got no smaller, and the yak horn got no bigger. So, in terms of the Mahamudra, just a beginning point, there's a real important word. That word is look. Look. It's different than watching. It's different than analyzing. It's different than cultivating mindfulness or awareness. It's simple and it's direct. And in the practices, we'll be doing short practices, the main practice all involve this element of looking. Just looking. So simple. It's so ordinary, so seldom done. You could say, well, of course I look all the time. I see this, I see all, you know, people all around. But this is you could ask yourself, if I look at my looking, what am I actually doing? Don't want to sound too complicated, but look directly. So it's ordinary and it's profound. That's also the quality. It is not complicated. It is not distant. It is not special. It's an interesting combination, I think, is Mahamudra is like as simple as oatmeal, but it's as charged as holding a live wire. It's both together. It's another thing. We don't trust ordinary experience. That's another way of saying we don't see what's going on. We always want to make something somewhat special. We want to make ourselves somewhat special. We want to make our practice somewhat special. We want to get out of the ordinary. We don't want to be an ordinary schlub. We want to be something special. If our practice is kind of nothing happening, then we think we got to make something happen. And then we think we can manufacture something. is connected with the very profound teachings of cool boredom. What if we didn't try to do any of that? They say we'd think, well, that would be a drag. We'd be so special. We wouldn't be special at all. It's like we suspect there's someone there, imaginary there, and we're like little kids. Say, look at me, look at me. You're like, hey, Mom, look at me. So the quality of wanting to be special, to be acknowledged, all of that. It's very striking, the imagery of the world coming to you that the Vijayadhara touched on in different ways. Like, the world can't come to us because we have all these barriers. We don't feel comfortable trusting what's right in front of our nose, the reality right in front of us. We don't trust it, so we make something else up. That's what we do. And that's what we're looking at here. Looking, look, look, look. So I have a couple short quotes. One thing just to point out, that this, the heart of the section on Mahamudra, where the Vijayadhara is talking about ground, path, and fruition, is a commentary on the Song of Mahamudra by Jangan Khontrol, which is in the book in the back. So you might want to look at that in your readings. It's in an appendix, right? According to Jangan Khontrol, ground Mahamudra is the view, understanding things as they are. And again, that is getting beyond those two issues of seeing what is not there and not seeing what is there. Right? Remember those two. And then there's a quote from the Vijayadhara in terms of this special, ordinary thing. There's a lot of play between special and ordinary in Mahamudra. And he says, this is really challenges our usual perception, to at least mine, that when the world is ordinary, it is always wonderful. When the world is ordinary, it is always wonderful, he says. And we work so hard to get out of the ordinary world to make something wonderful happen. Okay. Actually, I'm going to do a different order. I was hoping in each of the talks in this program, we could have a brief practice period in the middle, very brief, 5 or 10 minutes max. So I'll do that, and then I'll do the concluding reading and question Q&A. Yeah. So the first fundamental and ever-repeated instructions in Mahamudra is to relax. Don't try to do too much at all. Just relax. And just look at your current experience as it is right now. Just look. There'll be thoughts or sensations or feelings or whatever, sense perceptions. notice any tendency to alter or edit your experience. Notice the commentaries and opinions about whatever your immediate experience might be. Notice the weird idea that you are experiencing something. Look into, what is that you? What is that experience? Where is the experience and where is the you? And where is the experiencing? At what point does an arising of a phenomenon become your experience? When does it become your experience? What experiences do you draw in? What do you push away? The Vijayadharma said that experiences arise and then we edit them. And then he said, ditch the editor. And then just, as the chant says, rest simply without altering it, which is the same as ditching the editor. You cannot be too simple. Okay. To continue, the view, again, maintaining this view, which is not really a view that you can hold on to in the usual way, like, you know, my candidate is best, is connected with, again, it's not a striving kind of approach, Mahamudra. It's relaxed, it's playful. It is, as Rinpoche says, a fresh outlook, a sense of fresh versus stale experience. All of these things, if you're a Mahamudra practitioner, you can observe in your thought process and in the way you go about your life, fresh, stale, adult, childlike, playful, called a natural relaxation. There's a Tibetan term, pakyang, natural relaxation. I think Rinpoche said once, relaxing your quivering nervous system, something like that. Did anyone experience quivering nervous systems, like all the time, yeah. Don't we? Yeah. So relaxing that, relaxing that. I have, I go to this exercise class because I'm getting old and decrepit, and so I have to do that, torturous things. So one of the last couple of weeks ago, the school was out, so someone brought along a couple of kids, you know, while we were doing the class. So, so one side of the class, there are all of us, like, you know, in synchrony with this instructor yelling at us, you know, do this, do that, or like that, you know, gritting our teeth very, you know, like just trying to endure and get to the end of the class. And then the other side of the room were these kids. And they were running around and they were having a grand time and playing with all the equipment, getting equal amount of exercise, or if not more, completely delighted. And I'm thinking, God, that's just like the way it is. That is not the, that just sums it up, you know. thriving, striving, trying to survive, trying to you know, degenerate even faster, and then it just like it was great. And I think the image of a playful delight is again part of this Mahamudra. It is a feeling. It is an appreciation. It is a playfulness, at the same time deadly serious in a very groundless kind of way. Deadly serious, groundless way. So, you know, while there's talk of about joy and delight and playfulness and natural spontaneous wisdom arising, at the same time there are stories of Milarepa, you know, building one tower after another and getting beaten up and then have to build the next tower and then the next tower, hard manual labor. So there's a quality of ordinariness there too, hard manual labor. But having done so, you can relax. It's like this place. There are a lot of hard manual labor to create this space, both what we've done and other people who built the building and bought the land and painted and all that, and all the people who set up the shrine room. Very, very ordinary, hard manual labor. And now, having done so, you could relax. You could relax. So I want to read this one section from the Grand Mahamudra because it's so essential for going forward. It's talking about these glimpses of reality and what to do with them. And it's connected with the topic of nowness, which came up also in the Vijayadara's talk, which is a very, very, very misunderstood term often. called resting in nowness. The natural ordinary state has to be cultivated and worked with in three ways. The first is by not preparing too much. It is by cutting off our preconceptions from the past. The second way is by not expecting a greater flash. It is by cutting off our preconceptions of the future. The third way is by not holding on to our present flash experience. It is by cutting preconceptions of the present. We simply rest our mind. This very ordinary mind of nowness. I think a lot of times people hear about cutting off, you know, all the arising from past. You know, when you look at your meditation practice, how much is regurgitating stuff from your past? And a lot of times people talk about not dwelling in all sorts of fantasies and plans for your future when you practice. But not so many talk about cutting off preconceptions of the present. Because then a lot of people say, yeah, I'm in the present now. And then you get attached to on now. And they say, forget that. You can't be attached to that either. I guess the whole thing goes, right? I think that's connected with the ordinary special thing. The feeling that if you can cut those things off and be present for a while, that's special. Anyway, going forward, it said this resting of the mind can be achieved by natural techniques. The posture that you've developed through shamatha discipline, the awareness techniques that you've been using, such as following the breath, still apply. As a result of such techniques, you begin to notice there are moments of gap, moments of fresh outlook, moments of letting go, moments of a natural sense of existence. There are moments of pagyang, or natural relaxation. At those points, you perceive glimpses of Mahamudra. That is the practice. So that's another interesting point, is that you have these techniques, which we're all doing just basic technique. You never change the basic technique, but it organically, you talked about organic as well last night, organically develops in certain ways. But all the pointers to Mahamudra experience that he mentions are times when we forget to try to make something happen in practice, when we lose the, even for instant, the second sense of I am practicing. We forget sometimes that I am practicing. And it's just practice. Instead of I am riding the breath, it's just breath. Instead of I am being aware, it's just awareness. So from time to time, we kind of tangle ourselves up by our own efforts to be good and do the right thing and practice well and all that. And there are times when it drops away. That drops away. But it only happens because of the discipline preceding it. And it's uncomfortable and kind of raw, kind of space. Even going back in the early times when Rinpoche talked about the rising of Vipassana from shamatha, he said it can feel as though you're messing up your practice. You can feel it as irritation or as some kind of undermining of your good discipline. So it has many different feeling tones. So I think that's enough for a starter, and we can have time for some stories or questions or dialogue.
I wonder if you could say something about the name Mahamudra. What is the symbol? I don't quite get what the symbol is. What is it a symbol of?
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk a lot about that in a future talk, but briefly, it said, all experience is stamped in this by the same qualities, which are emptiness, luminosity. There's also the notion of symbol, which we'll explore much more. is in this case, it's a very, very different notion of symbol than our usual approach. We have a symbol of something. We think this is a symbol of that. You know, that's a symbol of awakened mind. Yeah. This is a symbol of awakened mind. That's a symbol of Robert. There's a sense of symbol of something. In the Mahamudra, the symbol and what's symbolized are the same.
Right, well, that's what's confusing, because symbol is sort of the basis of conceptuality and language, but that's not what Mahamudra is about.
Would you say that again?
Symbol is sort of the basis of conceptuality, you know, having an idea. You have a kind of model, or language is all symbols, but Mahamudra seems to be beyond that. So it seems odd to say symbol.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a broader sense of symbol. It's saying that it's kind of like WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. There is nothing behind it. There is nothing outside it. There's nothing underlying it. It's like immediate expression of the entirety.
So it doesn't transcend symbolism. It
doesn't transcend anything.
It's a symbol of itself, basically.
There's no itself. It's a great symbol, a great symbol, Maha Mudra, that there's one genuine, you couldn't even say one, actually, genuine gesture that is display of the essential nature of things. And it's completely ordinary, completely right there. And there's nothing behind it. Nobody's making it, creating it. It's not pointing to somewhere other. There's nowhere to point, you know. We'll talk more about it.
Yeah, so since I start this path, the idea is that you sit and you don't expect anything. Nothing is going to happen. But I expect a lot of things. I expect to be more calm, to be more...
You expect a lot of things.
A lot of things. And now there is another thing to expect. And it's, forget that I'm practicing. So now I know that I need to... So all the discipline, because there is going to be a moment. So there is something else to expect. So how to harmonize both things... Yeah. And how, yes, how to harmonize both. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's where light touch is so important. You'll notice expectations all the time. You know, they seem to never stop, at least for me. Even expecting, you know, there's be lunch next. You can expect that, you know. But beginning with seeing the kind of clutter and the way that what we think is important is never here. It was there or somewhere ahead, never here. And so it's like those, you know, one of those, that math thing where you get closer and closer and closer, you never reach the, and what's that called? Yeah, something like that. You get closer and closer, you never get there. That's what we do for ourselves. We set up things, we never get there. And we miss, so we fixate on certain things, and then we miss everything else. We're not happen to be fixating on at that moment, you know? So some people, their main preconceptions are the past, and they've decided how things are. And then everything amazingly becomes like that because they decided that's the way they were. Or other people really future-focused, striving to something that they think that it's going to make their life better. It's really hard to stay with your life just the way it is right now and see that it's complete, it has... you don't have to look beyond that. But it's paradoxical because people then work really hard. And they do things like practice and study and things like that. But again, so maintaining the view, knowing that you're doing that as a way of cutting through those preconceptions rather than just trying to figure out some strategy to make it happen. At one point, it was a slightly different context, so I'm not sure if it's totally relevant, but at one point, the Vijayadara said that something really shocking. It was more slightly in the more the Ati teachings, but I think it's relevant here. It was at the Crazy Wisdom Seminar that he gave in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and at one point he said, well, you know, all these practices and study and stuff that you're all doing, it's just to keep you occupied until you actually, you know, just wake up. So that was kind of a shock. You say, well, okay. I think he was trying to point to some that things are more immediate than we realized. We think so little of ourselves and so little of the world and around us. Anyway, yeah. Is Ryan Horn?
So in this tradition, there's such an emphasis on having a teacher, and I was wondering, when you're talking about the gaps in everyday life and maybe even in the early stages of practice, if it's possible for someone to have a Mahamudra experience, but they just didn't know what was that, or is there kind of like this necessity of instruction and a teacher?
Mm-hmm. We're going to this whole talk on that, but... I think that goes in the category of not seeing what is there. And that's the teacher role traditionally in Mahamudra is just pointing out something that we didn't notice, you know, so being able to see what is there, which is awakened, luminous, empty quality of reality. So that's the role of a teacher, and just very briefly. But also I think... Mahamudra, sometimes the Vijayadara referred to it as, actually it should be called devotion Mahamudra, because it's so based on opening of the heart, not just a mental thing. And that usually comes about by a connection to a teacher. Mm. But I think, it's an area of great preconceptions that we have of student and teacher and what the teacher does. I think we all hope the teacher will just do it for us. I do anyway. That didn't work. You know, the teacher just lay it on you, you know. But all they do is point you something and the rest is up to you. You know, Vijayadara said that many, many times. It's up to you, sweetheart, he would say. Yeah. Yes.
I'd like to ask about dropping. When you gave the pointers on meditation on your first talk here, the summarized meditation, at the end you said, and we can just also drop it. And you said we could even drop the whole retreat. And everybody laughed. And But then that was the end of the discussion about dropping it.
We dropped that discussion.
But now you've revisited it with a lot more detail. And you said these three things. It's not I am practicing, it's just practicing. It's not I am riding the breath, it's just breathing. And it's not I am aware, it's just awareness. So when we come to that point about the dropping, it's not I'm dropping it.
No.
Is it self-existent dropping?
It just drops.
So the point would be to acknowledge that and respect it, rather than to get upset by it.
Well, I think it's to appreciate.
Appreciate.
Yeah, and the problem is then that we tend to then try to make that happen.
Right.
You know, we say, oh, huh, yeah, that was cool. That was just, I actually wasn't so heavy-handedly there doing stuff. It was such a relief not to be me practicing. But then, of course, then we go right back.
Well, then you say, I got to do this again sometime.
Yeah, and then, of course, that makes it worse.
Yes, that's bringing it back to I am.
Yeah, so we'll talk more about that. But even in the Hinayana instructions, which are filled with Mahamudra instructions, you just drop that experience. You had the experience of dropping, you drop that.
Right.
But you touch it first. There's a touch and go. We'll talk more about that. It's good to recognize there's a potential for not doing what we do and having much more kind of freedom and spaciousness of mind. It's good to notice that. And it's also good to notice how then we try to create space ourselves. We try to make space, and you can't do that. Yeah. Yeah, so.
Is it related to the concept of I threw it all away?
I threw it all away?
Yeah. Throwing it all away. I threw it away. Threw it all away.
No, it threw you away. That's more like it. There's no it exactly, but it's just thrown away. You know, like that.
Thrown away.
Yeah, it's great. In Nova Scotia, they talk about people from away. So we could talk about people thrown away. No, but it's very much about that. We try so hard to create something in order to drop it. And that's what practice is. We try really hard to do something that we need to completely drop. It goes back to Carmen's question as well. It's like, isn't that a funny and profound way of going about things? Yeah. So I think that's it. And created the sequence of classes to respect the way in which the Vidyadhara presented the Mahamudra. So we're going right back, combing our hair from the root to the Hinayana techniques, Mahayana, and then more on Mahamudra, the path. So this is more about just a general view and introduction. And again, it's not that we're changing the techniques of the practice, but we're working with it from a different perspective. So holding the view, not getting caught in the form and missing the essential point, I think would qualify as holding the view, I think. You know. So thank you all to dedicate a merit. By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.